Curse.
Welcome to Speak and Destroy, episode 107. Established in 2016, Speak and Destroy is the first podcast to feature interviews about Metallica. I'm your host, Ryan J. Downey, and my guest this episode is Brody Utley, guitarist for Tech Death Metal Masters, Rivers of Nile. Remember, the best way to support this show is on Patreon, where you get access to bonus episodes culled from my interview archives over the years, and also to go into Apple Podcasts or whatever your preferred podcast platform of choice is, and leave a 5-star rating and write a nice little review. Those really help. You can follow the show on social media, subscribe on YouTube, follow me on Twitter at Ryan Downey, and on Instagram at SuperheroHQ. So here it is, my conversation with Brody Utley of Rivers of Nile. This is Speak and Destroy.
I was born in 1991, so Year of the Black Album, you know, great year. My dad was way into a lot of like 60s and 70s music. My parents had me when they were a little bit older, so like my dad's 68 now. He was, you know, born in 53, I guess. So he was, you know, a young man for you know, a really important time in music, you know, the late 60s, early 70s. He got to see all that kind of happen right in front of him. So, he had a huge record collection, all the like the best stuff from that era, whether it was, you know, pop or blues or prog or, you know, whatever. He just, you know, always had it laying around the house. And I think like my first memory of, you know, really like being moved by music, not just like seeing music as like sounds, that didn't really necessarily hold any like deep personal value to me. Probably the first band for that I connected with, I was probably maybe 7 or 8. I got really into the Beach Boys. I heard Surfing USA, you know, like the guitar line coming in. And, I thought that was like the coolest thing ever, just like that, like kind of, you know, Chuck Berry style of blues guitar playing. And that was like the first band that like I really, you know, got into, made my dad like get me their best of CD and stuff and just like play the hell out of it. And then, as I like kind of, you know, started realizing that I liked music, particularly like guitar stuff, you know, like there's pictures of me as a kid holding like a tennis racket, you know, pretending it's a guitar, like all that stuff, you know. I remember my dad showing me a video for Inagata De Vita by Iron Butterfly, and it was like an extended version. It was a VHS tape and it was the non-radio version of the song. So it was like 15 minutes long and it featured like a solo section from each instrument, you know, and there's like this, you know, 4-minute long section of the guitar player with this like shiny red, you know, guitar, just like making these squealing noises. It's not, me and my dad used to call it the elephant noise. And I just thought that was the coolest thing ever, you know, bright red, shiny guitar, crazy noises. And that's like pretty much when I was like, I want a guitar, you know, I want to play guitar.
How do I do that? How do I make that elephant noise?
Exactly. So of course my dad does, the responsible thing, and he goes and he gets me a 3/4 size classical guitar, which, you know, as a, an 8 or a 9 year old, like is not necessarily the coolest thing ever because you just want to, you know, make crazy noises or whatever. So, it was like, I guess the catalyst for me wanting to actually get my first guitar was, was Iron Butterfly. Just that one video just kind of set it all off, because there was a section in that where the drummer did this crazy solo, and I was just like, this is awesome. Like, just the energy of that whole thing was just like so like hypnotizing to me. Like, I thought it was the coolest thing ever, you know. And yeah,
after... Dude, the Slayer version of Inagata De Vida, you've heard that, I imagine.
I've never actually heard that. I didn't know that. That's probably amazing, though.
It's insane. Yeah, it's from one of my, I'd say it's my second favorite movie soundtrack ever, the soundtrack to the film Less Than Zero, which was a movie with Andrew McCarthy, Jamie Gertz, and Robert Downey Jr.
Yeah.
And the soundtrack has the Bangles doing Hazy Shade of Winter, mm-hmm. which is incredible. Mm-hmm. Poison covering Kiss Rock and Roll All Night. Mm-hmm. Slayer doing Inagata De Vida. The soundtrack's produced by Rick Rubin, by the way.
Oh, okay. That's killer.
Roy Orbison doing Life Fades Away, written by Glenn Danzig.
Yeah, okay.
And the first Danzig song, other than the Who Killed Marilyn single, the first like Danzig solo song, because at that point Rubin had signed Samhain, which was in the process of becoming Danzig, mm-hmm. and he had Glenn write a song, the theme song to the movie. Actually, it's called You and Me Less Than Zero. It's credited to Glenn Danzig and the Power and Fury Orchestra. Mm-hmm. And Ruben's idea was originally to have the Power and Fury Orchestra be like his house band that he would have various artists collaborate with. I think it ended up being the only song.
Yeah.
And it was written with the intention that a woman would sing it. Mm-hmm. And Danzig recorded just a demo of it just to give to whoever ended up performing it. And the record company and the film producers and everybody involved was like, who's this singing the demo? Like, this is great. Let's just keep this. Yeah. So it's this like weird outlier, awesome Danzig deep cut. But yeah, Inagata De Vida on there. I mean, obviously I know the Iron Butterfly song, but I've probably listened to the Slayer version more. So when I hear that song in my head, it's
the Slayer version.
It's a little faster, but it's,
well, I would hope so.
Yeah. But it's pretty faithful.
Damn. Okay, I'll have to check that out. Yeah, I've believe it or not, I've never heard. I had no idea Slayer covered that, and that's also very sick that Rick Rubin worked on that. He's like, anything that guy has to say, I always like pay attention. Like, doesn't really matter who he's talking to. I just like listen to that guy talk, because you know, so much history and knowledge there. I just listened to a podcast of him on Marin, where he was like talking about, you know, bringing, you know, the Johnny Cash's like career resurgence towards the end of his life, and like what it was like working with him during that time, and like just like crazy stories. Like,
I need to listen to that episode. You know what's interesting is that the thing he did with Cash, he had done with Roy Orbison just a little bit before. That was almost like the template for what he ended up doing with Cash. And yeah, he had put Roy Orbison and Glenn Danzig in the studio together. Mm-hmm. And Danzig wrote, I think, two songs for him. And, you know, Orbison at that time was just kind of like an oldies act, you know?
Right.
Yeah. And that really brought him back around. And then his next record was like huge. Like, he had like a huge record towards the end of his life as a result of the Rubin thing. And then, yeah. And then the cash thing happened like almost, I don't know, maybe 4 or 5 years later, but it was like the Roy Orbison thing with Rubin was kind of the template.
Yeah. Yeah. He was talking about, I think he talked about Roy Orbison on that episode as well. And he was saying, similar to Roy Orbison, how you were saying he was just sort of known as an oldies act up until that point. He was saying basically the same thing about Cash, where like he said that at right before, you know, he had ended up working with Cash on what would, you know, go on to be like some of his most like, you know, successful and known stuff that he had done in his career. Cash was playing in like, you know, like dive bars, basically, you know, like to like, you know, 50, 80 people, you know, like he was like very much like, you know, not on his way out, but like, just like, you know, he was kind of just known as like this, like more oldies guy, I guess, at that point. And like Rick just, you know, went into all these details about like that whole process, and like, you know, talked about how like Cash's mind worked, and like how he saw himself, and like, you know, for being Johnny Cash, like some of the stuff that he was talking about, I was just like, damn, like I guess, like, you know, a lot of artists, like, you know, are going to end up doubting themselves no matter what, and being down on themselves no matter what, like, no matter how big their name gets, you know, it still, you know, goes back to, like, a lot of these guys just have, like, issues with, like, confidence and stuff. And, like, it seems like Rick was really able to, like, you know, shake him up and, like, get him going again. But anyway, yeah, that's crazy. I'll have to check out the Slayer version of Inagata De Vita, though, because I feel like it's kind of weird that I haven't heard that. So I definitely need to check that out. But yeah, that was what started it all, I guess, was just like the original version of that song. And then I kind of, you know, got into, and then I got into like Pink Floyd and Led Zeppelin and Ozzy Osbourne and then Metallica after that, you know, and then kind of just kept getting going down the rabbit hole more and more and more, you know. But I guess originally it goes back to the Beach Boys and Iron Butterfly for me.
That's pretty awesome, because I think that you could actually follow a thread, you know, backwards, reverse engineering what you do with Rivers, because it's like, you know, there's some melodicism in there and that's the Beach Boys, and there's you know, some kind of that sort of adventurous musical landscape kind of thing, which is like Iron Butterfly, you know, in a way. So those are really cool ingredients to see so far back in your history. So what was the first Metallica moment that you can remember, like the first song you heard or the first video you saw? Or
the first time I remember like becoming aware of Metallica was, you know, and it wasn't after this first thing. Like, I didn't like get into them after this. It was a little bit later that I got into them. But I remember when I was like, I couldn't have been like any older than like 7 or 8, being at my grandmother's house, and like they had like VH1 on or something like that. It was like one of those programs from then. And like, I think they were playing, it may have been like a Behind the Music on the Black album or something like that. And I just remember hearing like the intro to Enter Sandman, just the dad and dun 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 dun. And like, I didn't know, you know. And as a side note, that same day I also saw the music video for Progenies of the Great Apocalypse by Dima Borgir. So it was like a double dose of like extreme music for me. I was like kind of terrified of it at that point because I was so young. But my first memory of Metallica was seeing them on MTV or VH1 at my grandmom's house when I was just like a little kid, and like, you know, just like seeing the dudes and like kind of being fascinated by it, but like not, you know, not like being quite ready for it yet, I guess. And it wasn't until probably like sixth grade, I think, where at that point in my life, I was very like, I was kind of like trying to figure out who I was, you know, because like where I went to school, it was when we hit sixth grade, the two elementary schools from two different towns combined into one middle school. And when I was in like sixth grade, you know, I was like kind of just, like I said, searching for my identity. And I like didn't really know, you know, I was kind of like did the skateboarding thing, but I also like to play sports. And then like, you know, I had short hair and like, you know, I was just trying to do all these different things to like figure out who I was. And I played piano and I played saxophone poorly, but I was in the school band, and there was a dude who played guitar in the school band, and like, you know, he was just like playing chords and stuff behind, you know, the whatever it was that the rest of the band was playing. But he had a Gibson SG, he had a huge pedal board, and he had like a PV Bandit combo amp or something. And in between, you know, us playing these songs for the school band, he would, you know, throw the distortion on and start playing Metallica songs. And like, I didn't know what it was, but then when I heard him playing Enter Sandman, I was like, I recognize that. Like, what is that? And like, he told me, you know, it's Metallica, like you should check this out. Like, you'll probably like it, you know? And like, I was just like, you know, totally fascinated because, like I said, when I was like maybe 7 or 8, my dad got me a classical guitar. I took some lessons on it. Didn't really click with me, 'cause like, I realized that like, you had to like, you know, oh, you have to hold notes down and play. Like, it's not just like hitting it and making cool sounds come out, you know? And as a kid, I was very like, you know, turned off by that. You know, I was just like, you know, this is hard. So like, I kind of put it away for a couple of years until I was like 12, I guess. And, you know, after I saw this dude like in real life playing, you know, this, you know, these making these sounds on a guitar in front of me, I was like, all right, I gotta, you know, I'm playing saxophone. I don't even like it. I'm not good at it. Like, I don't, you know, I can only learn so many, like, you know, Beatles. I mean, love the Beatles, but like, I can only learn so many Beatles songs poorly on the piano. You know, like, I want to try something new. So I actually, I sold my bike. I sold my PlayStation. I sold my Game Boy. I sold a bunch of my Pokemon cards. And I went out, and it's kind of embarrassing because, like, I I'm in touch with this guy who's in the band. His name's Andrew. And I saw him a couple of years ago, and it's funny because I bought the same guitar he had, which, like, now as an adult is kind of like, that's kind of cringy, you know. But, like, you know, I was a kid and I was just like, this is so sick. Like, that's the coolest guitar ever. I bought the same exact guitar as him. We talked about it a couple of years ago. He came out to one of our shows and he thought that was amazing. I was like, dude, I was like, you know, like, you're the guy that kind of like got me, like,
Think the show is cool. I wouldn't be playing the show if it wasn't for you.
Dude, straight up. I mean, like, I probably would have just like poorly played saxophone for the rest of high school and then, like, you know, went to trade school or whatever, you know, like, so yeah, it was like he was very much the catalyst for me to like stick my head back into that world and like really dive in. And that time I really went all in on it, you know, like, you know. And I was a big fan, this kind of relates to Metallica because of Kirk and the wah pedal, but like, I got a wah pedal with my first setup right away, like right off the bat. I got a guitar, an amp, and a wah pedal because I thought that sound was the coolest thing ever on a guitar. So it's just funny to me that I had to get a wah pedal like before I even knew how to play it, you know. But yeah, that was pretty much the catalyst for, you know. And then, you know, my dad took me to Borders Books, you know, I don't think they have those anymore, but he took me to Borders Books and I got the Black Album, and I think I got Ride the Lightning. And those were like the first two Metallica albums that I got. And I would just, you know, take them on the Discman to school every day, you know, pick which one I wanted to bring with me and just like jam it on the way to school, jam it on the way back, jam it in a study hall and stuff. So, yeah.
Oh, I love it, dude. I love it. And I love that idea that, you know, getting that guitar set up and everything, like, just immediately, you know, replaced everything for you, right? Like all the other hobbies, all the other fascinations, like, nope, this is the thing now.
Yeah, it was an obsession at that point. Grew my hair out, you know, started wearing the t-shirts, yeah, like, whole thing, went all in.
and catch me up then, to, because, yeah, you were born, so you're 30. I know that because you were born in the year of the Black Album.
yep.
So where was Metallica at in their career around this time that you're like really getting into it?
I mean, this probably would have been around like, probably like around 04.
Okay.
I'm guessing like I remember. Yeah. So what was going on in 04 with them? I'm pretty bad with like my 2000s era Metallica timeline. So what would have been happening around?
Yeah. Time? 04 would be Saint Anger would be the most recent record at that point.
Okay. Well, that makes sense. Cause I remember going to like Guitar Center with my dad and picking up like the ESP catalogs and seeing like, you know, Kirk, like on the front cover and like all of his, you know, models with ESP and LTD. Like, I feel like there was like a heavy, I mean, I guess there's always like a heavy like Metallica presence, but like I felt like it was like extra intense then because I guess it was, yeah, like just a couple years, you know, after Saint Anger had come out. But yeah.
Yeah, because Saint Anger was summer of 2003.
Okay.
And then yeah, and so they 2004 they would have still been on tour for that. And then Some Kind of Monster,
yes,
was actually at Sundance January 04. And then I think it wasn't released until it might have been later that month. I actually don't know when it was released in theaters, but I remember seeing it at Sundance. It was the only time I've been to Sundance in 2004. But yeah, so that would have been contemporaneous with what they were doing. What were some of the first songs of theirs that you started figuring out?
I think one of the, well, I mean, I think Enter Sandman was like the first one. And I think I like learned it incorrectly. Like, I was just playing it how I like thought I, you know, how I thought it sounded, I guess. And then, you know, I like was playing it incorrectly. Like it didn't even sound close, but like I thought it did, because like I was just going, you know, based on memory or whatever. Cause I think I actually tried to like figure that out before I even had a copy of the CD. I was just trying to like reproduce what I heard the guy playing, you know, in the jazz band at school. And then when I started taking lessons, I think me and my first guitar teacher, we did Enter Sandman, probably did Fade to Black. I think Fade to Black was actually like one of the first official like guitar solos that I learned.
Oh, right.
You know, like, I mean, I couldn't do the like, you know, I couldn't play that quite, you know, up to speed at that point, but like it's a good solo, you know, to start with, like kind of as a young player, because it's like it just sounds real good. It's real melodic and everything like that. So yeah, I think Fade to Black, probably Enter Sandman, probably, yeah, For Whom the Bell Tolls. I mean, you know, that the dun 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 dun, dun, all that stuff is just like great, you know, great for new players. To just like get stoked on like, you know, learning something, then having it sound pretty sick, you know, in a hurry, I guess. So yeah, it was, like I said, like Ride the Lightning and the Black Album were like the two records that I like really dove into for a while, you know, in my early stages of being a guitar player. And then it wasn't until a little bit further down the road, you know, cause like this was still before, obviously before streaming and everything like that. So like still had to go out and buy the CDs, right? Like my family didn't have great internet. We always had like dial up and like really slow internet. So I couldn't even really participate in, illegal downloading or whatever, you know, like I couldn't even do that because my internet was so shot. So I would have to wait to go get the CDs, but, you know, and Justice for All and Master of Puppets came a little bit later for me, but the Black Album was like the big one for me. And Black Album and Ride the Lightning for sure.
And obviously the Black Album is, you know, on everyone's minds in terms of Metallica right now, with the Blacklist thing coming out and the box set and all the celebrations, you know, biggest selling record of the SoundScan era, which March 91 being when they started, when Nielsen SoundScan started counting sales. Right. Yeah. You know, I mean, just a monumental, and still, you know, selling thousands of copies a week in North America alone, which always blows my mind, because you think, like, first of all, you think about how few people are purchasing records, even in legal downloads, vinyl, compact discs. Yep. And then to think that like there's 2,000 of those people every week in America that are like, you know what I need right now? I need the Black Album from Metallica from 1991. I'm going to go buy that. I don't own it, or I used to own it, or whatever. I mean, it blows my mind that it continues to do that. What do you think it is about that record that causes it to endure in such a big way and to cast such a shadow over, I mean, you know, it's Back in Black, it's Led Zeppelin 4. Yep. It's, you know, it's one of those records that is just, you know, despite the fact that without the Black Album, Metallica would still be a massively influential band with a bunch of huge records. Mm-hmm. That record is just, it's insane how big it is. What do you think it is about it?
I mean, I think that it's just like such a pinnacle for so many things. Like, I mean, there's something that, you know, anyone, you know, I mean, if we're just talking about like, you know, the world of musicians and music and just like real like hardcore fans of like, you know, heavy metal, I mean, there's so much that those people can take away from it, you know, as far as like, you know, it being like a pinnacle of like modern production at the time, you know, and like still, I mean, holds up, and like, you know, all the live recordings from that era, it's just like, it's, you know, it sounds like the record. I mean, those drum sounds, you know, it's like you listen to anything from that era live, it's like, you know, they were just so dialed at that point, you know. So like, in the sense, it's like, you know, production wise it's a pinnacle. So like you have, you know, professionals and fans of the genre that can look at it like that, you know. And then additionally, like, so that's like more for like the nerds, right? But then like also, you know, it's highly accessible, right? Like you have songs like you have songs like The Unforgiven and Nothing Else Matters, you know, like my, you know, my girlfriend who doesn't even really like heavy metal very much. Like when I met her, like she had like an orchestral version of a bunch of, well, I guess it was and Nothing Else Matters, you know, I think it was that the orchestral version that she had. It's like, you know, there's just songs on there that are like, you know, great for so many different, you know, groups of people, I guess, like, you know, whether it's like the starting musician who's like just getting into guitar music, you know, if you play, you know, like a mid 90s death metal record with insane blast beats and double bass and fills and just like wall of sound for like, you know, a lot of like people who are just kind of getting into the genre, it sort of just like blows them away and goes over their head, right? Sometimes, sometimes it doesn't. But like, I feel like, you know, that record in particular, it just has, you know, it just has like such a good, like, it's such a good on-ramp to the genre, I guess. You know, and it's not, and it's like the songs aren't, you know, so extreme that it would like scare someone away. But they're also like so well composed and like just simple enough in like the perfect way that like it's still, you know, massively appealing to like the true fan of like heavy metal, but it's like also like this fascinating thing to like someone who like, you know, might not necessarily generally be into the genre. So like I think it's just like it's got so much, there's so much about it that's just like universal, I guess, you know. Trying to like think if I can, if there's like, you know, a less wordy way I can put it, but you know, it's just yeah, it's just a fucking great record. Like, it's simple in all of the best ways and like not in not simple in all the best ways. Right. You know, and it's just a landmark album for the band, for production, for their playing. I mean, for the era, I mean, them coming off of And Justice for All, you know, like watching those like Seattle 89 videos, you know, knowing what was to come next. Like, it's just like, I don't know, that's just like such a, like a magical era in that band's career, you know. I mean, it was in general, but for me personally, it's like that's such a fascinating time in that band's career for me. But I think to answer your question, yeah, I think it's just like, it's just it's a perfectly put together record that's like, you know, designed to stand the test of time, you know, just like, you know, like you mentioned some other records, but like, just like same as Dark Side of the Moon from Pink Floyd, right? That album is like so weird, you know, in certain ways, so that it still appeals to like the music critic, I guess, but so simple in other ways that it appears to like the guy who's just like going to work or whatever, you know? And I think that the Black Album is like, it's a record like that, you know, it has something for everybody. And it's like a great on-ramp for, you know, listeners and, you know, musicians alike, you know, for the genre.
Absolutely, man. Well said. And, you know, you mentioned the production earlier, and I tell this story on the podcast all the time, but, you know, I remember talking to my buddy CeCe, the drummer for Black Veil Brides, who's actually been on the podcast, but talking to him years ago when they were working with Bob Rock. And, you know, a lot of conversations bands have with producers about tone and references and things like that when they're starting. Bob was asking CeCe early on, like, you know, what are some of your favorite records in terms of drum sounds, what kind of drum sound and stuff do you want to go for? And CeCe was just like, the Black Album. Mm-hmm. That's, you know what I mean? There is just something so magical about what was captured, even from a production standpoint, to say nothing of you know, all of the obvious varying strengths from a songwriting standpoint.
Yeah. I mean, it's just like, yeah, it's a fantastic record. I mean, production wise, you know, being that, you know, I'm the guy in my band who, you know, handles most of the production stuff. I record, you know, I guess like a little over half of the stuff that ends up on our records. I do all the, you know, guitars here at my place and a lot of the like supplemental instrumentation. So I'm like a real student of like production, you know, so all that stuff is very fascinating to me. And this is kind of a sidetrack, a side note here, but after, you know, it wasn't until I had been into Metallica for a long time. And, fallen deeply in love with like the production on the Black Album, that I realized that, Bob Rock did Dr. Feelgood as well, that was another one of my favorite records, like coming up. I like got like real deep into Motley Crue, and the sound on both of those records is just like enormous for the time, right? Like Dr. Feelgood, what was that? Was that 89?
I want to say Dr. Feelgood was 90. It was somewhere in there.
It was right before the Black Album though. And like,
yeah, it was before the Black Album for sure.
Yeah. And you can,
yeah, you know, I mean, what I think? It was, I'm gonna look it up. Actually, I think you're right. It was 89. Yeah. In fact, it celebrates its anniversary 2 days from now.
Oh, wow.
There August you go. 28th, 1989.
Damn. So yeah, but like that, I remember hearing, cause like I went through, I was like a huge Guns N' Roses fan. I like went through a big, 80s phase, a whole bunch of bands from the 80s. And, Motley Crue always, that record in particular always stuck out to me because of like just how heavy it was, just like dun 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 dun, and it's funny that like, yeah, that was like closely related, production wise sonically to the Black Album, which is like another one of my favorite, sounds on a record, a heavy metal record of all time. But yeah, just I've dove deep and done tons of investigating on all the stuff that went into that album. And, I'll never say no to anyone who wants to watch, a year and a half in the life of Metallica. It's like something that I'll always, no matter how many times I've seen it, I just like love watching those dudes just, being young men firing on all cylinders, getting into it with one another and, and hanging with one another and having a good time with one another and just, just really being like being a band, like that's like, I think for, as changed as the world is now, and how so many bands are just like, kind of like all their members are like scattered all over the country or the planet, even, I still think, deep down inside, I'm still very much in love with the idea of like the band, like the band dynamic, just like having your dudes, having the people, that you work with and can depend on and are your friends. And like, you go through the shit together and you also go through, the high points together as well. And it makes it all the more worth it, cause you've been it together, for so long and been through so much together. And I think that, a lot of that kind of goes back to, watching those Metallica videos, that's my favorite part. Like I just like love watching those dudes just like talk about whatever, just like in the studio, I think that, that's like a pretty underrated part of like, the band dynamic is just like, seeing how bands interact with one another. Like you could tell a lot about how, comfortable a group of guys are with each other, based on just how they're kind of like shooting the shit, And like, I think that it's fascinating to just like, just watch all that take place. Cause in some way or another, it's going into whatever music it is that they're making. So, anyway, yeah, I think I lost track of what.
No, in fact, I absolutely wholeheartedly agree. And believe it or not, I think in more than 100 episodes, you're the first guest to really address that. And as you're talking about it, it's making me think, that is a huge part of what has resonated with me for so long about this band, because there are, there are lots of bands of lots of different genres that I love, including other metal bands. I'd say often that Megadeth was the band that got me into heavy metal and still one of my all-time favorite bands.
Yeah.
But there is something about, and I would include Mustaine in this by extension.
Right.
There is something about, yeah, just the inner workings, the conversations, the attitudes, the origin stories. And I suppose it has a lot to do with the almost unparalleled access that these guys have given us into their interior lives, right, without sacrificing too much, because we don't see, Hetfield and his wife at home or anything, right, nor do I think we should.
Right.
But we do get so much of who they are and what informs and shapes their music. And a lot of it has been, for better or worse, I realize, instructive for me, even like you mentioned a year and a half in the life, I always think about this scene, and I don't say this, this was important to me even before Newstead had left the band. So I'm not saying this anything to do with him leaving, but just as a life lesson in general, there's a great moment in there, and I'm paraphrasing it, but he's like backstage and there's all this catering and it's all luxurious and they're at their absolute peak, you know, it's the Black Album tour, and he's like making sandwiches from hospitality to take back to his hotel room, and whoever's filming him is like, Jason, what are you doing, you know, like, what are you making these sandwiches to bring back to the room? And he was just like, nothing lasts forever, man, you know. It's just there's just like this great attitude, and it's very blue collar and very, you know, I know he's Newstead's from Michigan and I'm from Indiana, and you know, Hetfield obviously comes from that, from a, that sort of a background as well. But I just love that, especially as they were blowing up just as we were leaving the hair metal era. And there was a particular era of rap that was just all about celebrating excess, materialism, hedonism, and was just like, look, you know, look how much sex I'm having. Look how much money I'm making. Look how much extravagance I'm just wasting on everything. And there was something about how even at their peak, not to say that there wasn't a certain bacchanalia happening behind the scenes with Metallica, but it wasn't this like same celebration of like, look how ostentatiously we're setting, you know, lighting cigars with $100 bills or whatever.
Right.
I just always had so much respect for the way that they carried themselves, and that whole idea of, you know, sign every autograph, take every picture, meet every fan.
Yeah.
But again, getting all the way back to what you were saying, I think is so insightful, is seeing the interworkings of their relationships with each other, because these are adult men now, you know, parents, and some of them have been married more than once. And, you know, they've gone through things that we all go through in life.
Yeah.
And yet the relationship with one another, you know, when you look at James and Lars in particular,
yeah,
that has endured for 40 years. Mm-hmm. You know, these two people who are very different in a lot of ways, but obviously share some important fundamental things that have tied them to one another forever. You know, there's a great, great moment during their Hall of Fame induction where James, you know, like publicly thanks Lars for, you know, getting all this going, and he like picks him up in this bear hug, and just it makes me emotional talking about it, thinking about the look on both of their faces in that moment. And it's so relatable for all. And because the other thing about the band, and this includes Cliff and Newstead and Robert, you know, historically, like there's always been very different personalities in the band. So I feel like everybody, no matter what kind of person you are, there's someone in Metallica that you can relate to, or there's aspects of different members that you relate to, and so on.
Yeah.
And I think part of the magic. I think you really hit on something that, of course, it's the music. Of course, it's the live show. Of course, it's the records, but that's a really big part of it too. And I think if they're almost singular in the way that they've let us in.
Yeah, man. And I mean, like, it's just like, you know, all that, and then just, you know, yeah, just seeing that they all have this, like, you know, mutual respect, you know, for this thing that they're doing. Like you were talking about, like the age of like excess and stuff that, like, you know, the Black Album came out on the heels of, you know, they, Metallica, like, you know, of course, like they were known for, like, you know, they drank and partied and stuff, but like they treated that shit like the job. Like, this is what we do, you know, like, and I don't know, just like seeing, you know, how long the respect for that thing that they do together, no matter like what goes on in their personal lives, like they've, you know, fought about it and worked it out and everything, but like, it's all for this, like, this thing that they started together like so long ago. And like, I'm still, yeah, like I love that, you know, like you know, the bass player of my band, Adam, you know, he and I have been playing music together since I was 16, you know, we've been in two bands together. And like, you know, it's obviously way different, but like, I you know, I love that like he and I, you know, started together in a lot of ways, and like have kind of, you know, become better players and musicians and gone through all these various phases of our lives together, you know, and, you know, moved apart. And like, we still have this thing and this kind of like silent, unspoken understanding with one another, where like we can be in a room with each other and just look at each other and like know exactly what the other guy is thinking. Same thing, you know, on stage, you know, that goes for like stage chemistry. Cause, you know, and this is something that, you know, that, you know, Wes Houck and I have talked about a lot, is the fact that like so many bands these days are just sort of like revolving doors of members, which is like, you can get a guy who can get up there and kill it, you know, like for all intents and purposes, but like, there is something special to be said about like, you know, having like a core lineup of guys that just like stick together. You kind of like learn each other's like, you know, small inconsistencies and how to kind of like compensate for like this guy if he's dragging, or that guy if he's rushing, or, you know what's going on in each other's, you know, heads without having to like, you know, walk up to each other and scream into each other's ear on stage. And, well, what's going on? You know, like, it's just all that goes back to like, you know, band chemistry, I guess. And like, I think, yeah, going back to what I said, like, yeah, I think that's like my favorite shit to watch for like, you know, Metallica, like in the Metallica, you know, videos, and in, you know, most bands' videos. I've always loved the behind the scenes, just the people in the band hanging out with each other. You know, like, I grew up watching behind the musics of, you know, tons of bands, whether it was Led Zeppelin or Badfinger or Pink Floyd or the Moody Blues. You know, like, I used to watch these VHS tapes that my dad had laying around, just of like these bands just like kind of interacting with one another and, you know, talking about life in the band and talking about like the industry and how it all works. And like, I think all that stuff and all the Metallica stuff that I watched growing up and still continue to watch, I don't know. I feel like it kind of like warmed me up in a certain way for like what I was getting into, you know, and like taught me, you know, taught me, you know, a decent bit about what it is that, you know, like what it is that I was getting into before I even, you know, experienced a lot of it. And, you know, I think, you know, seeing guys, you know, the Metallica guys, you know, fighting it out and having these like major issues with one another, you know, especially on Some Kind of Monster, like some of that stuff just feels like you shouldn't even be watching it. It's so intense. You know what I mean? But it's just like, this is like the biggest heavy metal band on earth. And like, they're just like having trouble, you know, just like normal people, you know, and like, but they work through it because they have this common goal. And like, it's, you know, it makes them a stronger group of guys, you know, going forward. So yeah, it's all connected. And I really love, that side of like the, of documenting, you know, music history, like just the side of things where it's just like people in the bands just being people. I think it's so interesting.
Absolutely. And it does, you know, I feel like whether or not you're part of a multi-million dollar operation that all these people depend on.
Yeah.
That we all can, whether it's a rock band dynamic, whether it's a business, a workplace, a family dynamic, we can all relate to a lot of that stuff. That's just, you know, relationships. And especially when the creative arts are involved in the mix of art and commerce.
Right.
And yeah. And I think that's what's so profound about it. You know, Joe Berlinger, who co-directed that movie with Bruce Sanofsky, who passed away, he wrote a really cool book, which is actually a quick read. I read it in a you know, flight from the West Coast to the East Coast once. But it's all about the making of that film from the filmmaker's perspective. And it turns out that the two of them as a directing duo, having made the Paradise Lost movies together and so on, they were going through their own internal kind of Some Kind of Monster stuff.
Yeah.
And benefiting from the work that was happening with Phil Toll and all this stuff as they're documenting it.
Yeah.
You know, it was helping them too. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I think that's, it's pretty incredible how relatable that can be. And I suppose in a lot of ways, it's like a lot of great music where, you know, someone writes a song inspired by this or that in their life, and all of these other people all around the world of all different generations end up relating to that song or that film or whatever it is, despite not having a direct connection to whatever that original experience was, but feeling something similar or getting something out of
it. I mean, that experience is the human experience, I guess. Yeah. Like there are certain albums that come along, you know, throughout history every now and again, that just like, yeah, they just like strike a chord with like the human condition, I guess, you know, where the kind of like message is painted in a way that's, you know, artful enough to be, you know, considered the sort of high art, but like also like, you know, relatable and understandable enough that it's like, you know, like I said earlier, like that the average Joe just like going to work can like connect with it, you know. It's like, yeah, and that it happens, you know, rarely, but like when it happens, it is big, you know what I mean? And those albums are the albums that like, you know, that yeah, stand the test of time. And like the Black Album is yeah, like the first album that I think of, you know, when thinking of records like that, along with the, you know, the records that you mentioned, and, you know, Dark Side of the Moon and all that, you know, those are those records, you know.
For sure. And I suppose that's a big part of why they endure. So what are, you know, and you touched on this a little bit already, but what are some of the things that you think you've learned in terms of lessons from watching those interband dynamics? And also, you know, from I guess it's a three-pronged question.
Yeah.
You know, the interpersonal dynamics, the production side, and the creative songwriting side.
Yeah, I mean, you know, just I think a lot of the stuff that you know I took away from, you know, particularly like Some Kind of Monster, you know, and like just like, I guess like seeing how, you know, explosive behavior, you know, can like damage, you know, can like damage a relationship or like complicate things. And just like, you know, how when you're in a band, you know, with a bunch of other people, like, you know, there's going to be stuff that comes along that, you know, not everybody's going to agree on. And like, you know, yeah, sometimes you're going to fight about stuff. You know, I'm trying to think of like a good way to phrase this. Cause I'm thinking in particular of the scene in Some Kind of Monster when James was either going to, I think it was when he had just gotten back from rehab, and Lars is like, kind of like yelling in his face. Right. Like I remember that scene like pretty dramatically, and just like, just the tension, I guess, in the air of that, you know, that moment, like it is something that, you know, I guess like I've come, not necessarily relating to like, you know, substance or anything like that, but like I've been in situations, you know, with my band where things have gotten like mega, mega tense. Right. And, you know, like things have gotten heated and like dudes have gotten very angry at each other, you know? And like, I guess like, just like, you know, being able to remember like why we're doing this, you know, like I said, like having this, like, you know, this band that we all kind of believe in, this like universal goal, like no matter like how much we argue and fight about stuff or how hard things get, or, you know, if tour gets canceled or show goes poorly or whatever, we're mad at each other about this or that, like, you know, always kind of considering this kind of like greater, this thing that's bigger than the sum of its parts, I guess, or however that saying goes, you know, just kind of considering that, which is what I'm sure all those guys were thinking about during that time. You know, that was probably the only thing that they were holding on to, because it seems like, you know, shit was real bleak during that period for Metallica. I mean, you know, with James being, I mean, James is, he's the front man, he's the singer, you know, it's James, you know what I mean? And like, he was like really hurting during that time. And like, that was probably an insanely difficult time for that band. And, you know, not knowing what the future was going to hold, not knowing if they were going to be able to continue being Metallica. Right. It's a terrifying thing, you know, I mean, you know, terrifying watching it, but I'm sure it was a bazillion times more terrifying for the guys that are in the band. It's like their whole, that's everything. Right. You know, so I think, you know, conflict resolution is something that I've like kind of learned a lot about, and just kind of like mutual respect for band members, you know, and realizing that it's okay to like argue with each other, you know, just as long as it's like out of respect and like kind of, you know, out of the greater good for what you're all working towards, I guess. And I think seeing like those harder, more difficult moments in those Metallica videos, I guess just like I said, it taught me a lot about what to expect. And like, I guess when those things came along, you know, instead of just like being childish about it and like, oh, giving up or like, you know, holding a grudge or whatever, just kind of like working it out, you know, like, and like talk, having like open dialogue, you know, if I'm being an asshole, I want you to tell me, just like, you know, if you're being one, you know, I'm going to tell you, like, we have to like, we're in a steel can with each other, you know, for, you know, 18 hours a day or whatever, like
the rolling coffin or as Zach Wilde calls it, the submarine.
Yes, exactly. You know, so like we all share this like living space together. We spend so much time together. Like, it would be nice if everything was all like friendly and like, you know, roses and sunshine all the time. But being real here, it's not always like that. You're going to argue, but like there's a healthy way to do that, you know? And like, I think that the further along I get with this, the older I get, the older we all get, the better we get at it. And I think a lot of it goes back to like, you know, the lessons that I learned from just like watching these bands, you know, like work out their shit with each other. It was like deeply, you know, it was a good learning lesson for me. And it's something that I still hold on to. You know, and as far as like, yeah, as far as like, production and playing and whatnot, I mean, just the level of precision that those guys were, you know, playing at, you know, like, I mean, I've seen a lot of those like isolated, you know, James guitar tracks, you know, come up recently, like they'll pop up on my YouTube recommendations, and just like, you know, now knowing, you know, how highly edited and like kind of like sneaky everything has gotten with like the, you know, progress of technology and the ability to kind of like, you know, play your stuff sort of half-assed and make it sound amazing. Listening back to like those recordings and knowing that these guys did this shit to tape, and it sounds like it was like, you know, James's rhythm tracks sound like they were, you know, edited to a grid, but they're not, it's tape. Right. And I think that's like, you know, I'm the lead guitar player in my band, but like, I think James, even though he's not, you know, the lead guitar player in Metallica, I think he's the guy that like had like the biggest impact on me as a player, just because like, you know, I grew up really wanting to learn how to play solos a lot. Like I wanted to shred, you know, and all that. And like, I spent a lot of my time working on lead stuff. And when I, you know, I guess like when I really dove into Metallica and like paid extra close attention to like what James was doing on top of singing, you know, his playing, it just how locked in and tight he was, like, it kind of just gave me like this real profound respect for like, you know, the craft of like rhythm guitar playing and like how important it is to like, even as a lead guy, you know, to have like a super, super strong, you know, rhythm side of your playing. So like James, you know, and just his whole, you know, setup, man. I mean, he's like, you know, wears the guitar low, had the hair, you know, no shirt, the Explorer.
I believe I've heard him refer to it as his satanic stance.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Me and Wes always, we call him King Regs, because like, he wears his guitar at regulation height, like down low enough. Cause like, you see guys that wear them like way up here, you know, James has it down way down low. Like he's that's good regulation height, you know? So we call him King Regs because he wears his guitar down low like that. And just looks real, real killer, you know? So like, yeah, he's just, you know, James has been a huge influence on my playing, you know, specifically rhythm playing. And just like, yeah, just like, you know, being a guitar player, man. I mean, he's just the full package, you know. He's a rock star, you know. And yeah, so like I learned a lot about like just, you know, tightening up my playing and like just being, you know, dedicating myself to like rhythm guitar playing and not just becoming like one of those, you know, guitar players that's like, you know, well, I'm better at this. I'm more of a lead guy or I'm more of a rhythm guy. Like I wanted the whole spectrum, you know, and I think James was like real important in like rounding me out as a player, I guess. And, you know, all the, you know, production stuff, like being able to play your parts, you know, it sounds funny even saying it out loud, but like, there's so many bands out there that, you know, never play in a room together, you know, before a record comes out. And like, you know,
so many, especially now, even to the point where it's weird for a lot of bands not, you know, to not do it that. I'm stumbling over my grammar here, but you know what I'm trying to say? It's like, it's so the norm to do it the more quote unquote modern way that it's strange for bands to get in a room and play everything together. You know, so many records are just created in the studio. I mean, obviously Saint Anger being a record like that,
yeah.
But for the most part, you know, it's James and Lars going through the riff tapes and some Kirk's riff tapes and whatever. Yep. And, you know, Lars doing some arranging. I mean, Enter Sandman is the classic example where it's this Kirk riff. And then Lars was like, what if we moved this here and did it this way? Yeah. And then it's this, you know, massive song. It's very old school, that approach, because now it's a lot of, for better or worse, not to even put a value judgment on it, but now it's a lot of people doing stuff on their laptop in their place and, you know, giving a Dropbox link to another person in the band that lives in a different state. Yeah. And, you know, this stuff being sort of assembled that way. And then, like you were saying, the song doesn't even get played as a band until you're about to go tour your record that's already finished.
Yeah. And that goes back to the chemistry thing. Cause I mean, I think sitting in a room with your drummer, you know, I think that's like the most important thing that like any band dude could do, is just like sit in a room specific, like particularly with the drummer, cause that's the backbone of the band. You know what I mean? And just like be able to hash out how riffs are going to feel when they're like stacked next to each other. Right. Like you could write stuff in a vacuum and just kind of like piece a song together, you know, riff by riff or whatever. But like, you really want to be in a room and like feel how that stuff, like, you know, all goes together. And then like, you know, I feel like, yeah, you know, a certain part of that art has been lost in modern times, you know, and even more so now with like all the lockdowns and everything, it's even harder for people to like, you know, get in the same room with one another. So like, yeah, deep, massive respect for like, you know, all the bands that did it that way. Cause like, I feel like, yeah, that just adds an even more personal touch to, you know, the music when like it's being, you know, it's being like, created in real time like that, you know, two human beings interacting with one another and just like the chemistry and everything. It's like, you know, huge part of it for sure.
Absolutely, man. Well, dude, this has been awesome. I knew you were going to be an amazing guest.
I'm glad.
What is there anything else that we should get into that was on your mind Metallica wise?
Well, I mean, nothing like really serious or anything. I had one short funny story. I had the Ride the Lightning shirt that I'm sure, you know, everybody's probably owned at some point or another, with the glowed in the dark with like the guy getting shocked on the back of it, you know, and got suspended for wearing that to school one time because my teacher thought that I was an evil person for having such a graphic image on my shirt. I got thrown out of class for wearing a Metallica shirt. She wanted me to turn it inside out, but I wouldn't. Took the suspension. So there you go.
I love it, dude. And that's what it's all about, is taking that suspension. Yeah. And I want to give a shout out to my oldest friend that I'm still in daily contact with, Matt Reese, who hopefully made it this far into this episode so he can hear me shout out him getting sent home from school for wearing an orange sport coat with it was a whole thing. Getting busted for wearing the wrong stuff. And I love that that's a continuing generational thing, because Andy Biersack from Blackville, he's the same age as you.
Yeah.
And he got in trouble for wearing, I think, the color green. He wore a Dropkick Murphy shirt, and like, what? Green wasn't allowed at school for some reason. Like, yeah, it's a whole thing. So
wild.
Shout out to people who continue to get in trouble for wearing the wrong clothes.
Take the suspension. Yeah.
Take the suspension. Yeah. That's the lesson to be learned. Well, dude, this is killer. And you are definitely somebody I would love to have back. Far, there's only been a couple of repeats. Doc Coyle is my three-peat guest.
Nice.
And Andrew Carter's been on twice. Three times, actually, maybe him, but I'd love to have you back, man. And
yeah,
more Metallica anytime you want.
I'd love to come back, man. I had a blast talking about all this stuff. It's good to meet you, and hopefully see you soon sometime in the future.